Good afternoon, and welcome everyone to Women's Magazine. I'm Kate Raphael.
Starhawk is perhaps the most famous witch in the world. She's also a global justice activist and organizer and a teacher of magical activism and permaculture. She's the author of 11 books, including the classic text, The Spiral Dance, A Rebirth of the Ancient Religion of the Great Goddess. She has also written the novels The Fifth Sacred Thing and Walking to Mercury. The Spiral Dance has been continuously in print for over 30 years, and Starhawk's work has been translated into 11 languages, including Japanese and Burmese. Her newest book is a picture book for children called The Last Wild Witch. She has spent a lot of time doing solidarity work in Palestine and recently went to Egypt to participate in the Gaza Freedom March. I first met Starhawk in 1983, where else but in jail, after the big Livermore Lab blockade. Welcome, sister.
Great to be here.
So let's start with your career. You started out studying fine arts and film at UCLA. I know that you also went to rabbinical school for a little while. Then you got a master's in psychology.
Well, I didn't actually go to rabbinical school, but while I was still in high school, I was starting to take courses at the University of Judaism. I had quite a strong Jewish education, and for a while I really considered, do I want to become a witch or do I want to become a rabbi?
So even in high school, you had the thought that you might be a witch?
In high school, I didn't really know what a witch was, but, you know, that was like in 1960. I graduated high school in 67, so it was 65, 66, 67. But I was starting to read tarot cards and starting to get interested in mysticism. I mean, it was the height of the 60s. You know, everybody was into something weird and unusual. And at the same time, I had continued my Jewish education beyond bat mitzvah and was always taking the after-school courses and the Sunday courses. And so it was a little bit later in the early 70s. Actually, at that era, it never even occurred to me in the 60s that a woman could be a rabbi. There weren't any women rabbis. There weren't any women cantors. It was later in 69, 70, 71, as the feminist movement revved up again, that started to be challenged. And there were women challenging sexism within the patriarchal religions, and then there were those of us who were sort of stepping out and saying, well, what if we got out of that altogether? And it was in that era that I met people who called themselves witches and started talking about this ancient nature-based worship and religion. They said witches, first of all, believed nature was sacred. And for me, that was something that was very important because my own personal, real spiritual experiences had always been in nature, not in the synagogue. And they also said sexuality was sacred. And that was really appealing to me at 16, 17. I was like, yes, you know, right? How come no other religion seems to think so? And they said that women could be leaders, plus the rituals and the things that we did were more appealing to me than, you know, the kind of worship service. At one point I thought, you know, if I became a rabbi, I'd have to go to services all the time.
So how much of ritual is about the practice and how much is about belief? I mean, I like going to rituals, but I can't really say that I believe in something called the goddess. What do you believe?
For me, it's not so much about belief. And I think in a funny way, that's what I carry over from Judaism. One of the things that I was always told was that Judaism, you don't have to believe in it in the same way you're supposed to believe in Jesus or something. You know, it's a practice and it's a set of ethics and it's a cultural tradition. And you're allowed to have your own independent thoughts and your own independent ideas. And we think of the goddess in some ways as more than a metaphor, though she is in a sense a metaphor. But I think of all the different goddesses, gods, whatever, as like doorways into certain kinds of experience. If you meditate on Hecate, you know, the crone, the goddess of the crossroads, the goddess of death, that will open up your connection, your link to very real and powerful energies and forces that exist within us and also exist around us. But it's kind of like you tune yourself to that wavelength, and then you start to have a different experience of death and of choices and of aging than you would without that meditation.
So the Spiral Dance just had its 30th anniversary, came out in 1979. For those who haven't read it, it's an amazing amalgam of women's history and comparative religion and stories from your personal experience and exercises and really a how-to for certain types of rituals and certain types of spiritual practice. It's hard to imagine thinking about modern witchcraft without the Spiral Dance. What was it like for you when you were researching and writing it? Who else were you working with? Who influenced you in developing this practice?
Well, when I was writing it, there wasn't all that much that was out about, certainly about the goddess and also about witchcraft. I remember when I first met some witches, they had us read Robert Graves' The White Goddess. And that was my first introduction even to the concept of a female deity, except for maybe, you know, the Greek goddesses you learn about in Greek mythology. So I was wading through The White Goddess at 17. Of course, Robert Graves, who was writing in the 20s and 30s, I think, he was sort of a product of an upper-class British education, right? He assumes that everybody, you know, learns Latin and Greek. But it was an illuminating book in that it brought forth this concept, again, that you could experience spirituality in female terms, and that was actually really core to Western civilization in ways that we were never taught about, and that there were survivals of it in poetry and mysticism and folk tales and fairy tales. The first witches I met were part of a group they called an American Celtic tradition, and they started training us. We had a little group at UCLA that we'd started as part of a project for an anthropology class. And we decided we were just going to start a coven, though we had no idea what a coven was. The next real teacher that I met around this was Z. Budapest, who at that time had a coven in Venice, in L.A., the Susan B. Anthony Coven Number 1. And at that point, that was already in the early 70s. It was the time where the feminist movement was having this resurgence. Women were having consciousness-raising groups all over the place. And the whole feminist agenda that we think of now, you know, around things like rape crisis shelters and battered women's shelters and everything, was kind of emerging out of these small groups where women would get together and talk about their own personal experiences. You know, rape had never been on anyone's table as a political issue before that. But when you sat in a group of 10 women and 6 admitted that they'd been raped or they'd been attacked or they'd been sexually harassed, kind of went, well, this is not just a personal issue. This is a political issue. And as part of those conversations, we'd start talking about religion and spirituality and how we were raised, and started to ask questions like, what does it mean when all the images of God are male? And in the course of those conversations, I started thinking, you know, there is this other religion nobody knows about where goddess is female. This should have some connection to this political movement for women's rights. But I thought I was the only insane person that thought that, because most of the feminist movement sort of had that Marxist perspective that says, you know, religion, all religion is the opiate of the people, and now it's patriarchal. And then one day I was driving down Lincoln Boulevard in Venice, and I saw a shop that said the Feminist Wicca. I jumped out of the car and ran in. There was Z, and we started talking, and she invited me to a ritual. And I discovered she had this whole coven with a couple hundred women involved. And Z came from a hereditary tradition in Hungary, where she grew up. And, you know, it's great. I just saw her yesterday at this big pagan conference I was at called Pantheacon. And she still has Susan B. Anthony coven up here, and she's still doing the work.
So that's interesting, because in a lot of feminist circles, at least right now, spirituality and activism are seen as somewhat at odds. So, but you're saying that you came to spirituality through feminist activism. Did you see a time when spirituality and activism started to split?
You know, for me, they've always pretty much been together. I mean, I was an activist in high school before I even became a feminist activist. During the Vietnam War era, you know, we organized our high school around students' rights. We had a very active student body there. I was writing for our high school underground newspaper. And for me, it was always part of the same thing. It was about how do we shift this culture, you know, that creates such injustice. You know, we have to shift it on the political level, but we have to shift it on the level of consciousness and belief and spirit that underlies those political decisions. When I was, I guess, 16, my friend Hilda and I came up to San Francisco. That was in the spring of 1967, right before the Summer of Love. And we stayed with her cousin Dottie, who was a graduate student who lived in the Haight. Our parents had no idea about the Haight-Ashbury, and that whole thing was happening. We didn't tell them, right? But we knew. And so we, you know, had this marvelous week hanging out in the Haight-Ashbury and then hitchhiking over to Berkeley to Telegraph Avenue. And there was like almost a geographic split. You had the hippies in the Haight who were the cultural revolutionaries. And then you had the politicos on Telegraph who were the political revolutionaries. And I remember we had a lot of long conversations about where did we belong, you know, on Haight Street or on Telegraph.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on listener-sponsored KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm speaking with Starhawk about her work in magical activism. So talk about the group that you helped to start reclaiming. What was the purpose of that, and what have you been doing for the last 30 years in the Bay Area and beyond to blend magic and activism?
Well, reclaiming began after I moved to the Bay Area in 1975. And when I moved here, I met a whole community of witches and pagans that already existed. There was a very strong group called NARUG, the New Reformed Order of the Orthodox Golden Dawn. That was a slightly tongue-in-cheek name that they had taken. They had started from a class at San Francisco State. They had taken this class on ritual, and they created a ritual, and the ritual worked, much to their surprise. They shifted consciousness. Something happened. So they began doing it again, and they created a community around it. And they had also started a kind of overarching network called COG, the Covenant of the Goddess, that got legalized as a religion, got its 501c3 and provided an umbrella and sort of the ability for people to do things like hold ministerial credentials, perform weddings, perform funerals. And I found that there was a community of people here who, kind of like me, had been activists in the 60s, who were coming into these questions around spirituality from a political perspective, who were artists or who were musicians or poets. And when The Spiral Dance, my book, got published in 1979, we decided to launch it with a huge ritual for Halloween. And we created the Spiral Dance ritual. And I just gathered up all of these people that I thought were really talented artists and writers and musicians, and we created this wonderful thing together.
The Spiral Dance, the ritual, just also had its 30th
That's
anniversary
right.
at Kezar Stadium. The first Spiral Dance I went to was back in the 80s, and it was a couple of hundred people at the Women's Building. For people who may not have ever been to a public ritual, can you sort of take us through what happens there?
Yeah, you know, the ritual is based on the basic pattern for our rituals in reclaiming, are that we first connect with the earth, we ground, we make an energetic connection ourselves with the earth. Then we create sacred space. We cast a circle, we honor the elements, the four directions, goddess, god, and then we do some sort of work. We have some kind of focus or intention that we create in some way and raise energy around it. When that work is done, again, we ground that energy, we connect it again to the earth, and then we thank everything that we invoked and say goodbye. So it's a simple pattern. You know, in the, we might do it, you know, in a home circle in a very simple way, just sitting around together, sharing things together, maybe sharing what's going on in our lives and giving each other some energy or attention for it. In the spiral dance, we like to do big public ritual. We really like to play with that edge about ritual and performance and art. So we have a chorus that trains for months before the spiral dance that sings music, which is much more elaborate than many of our simple pagan chants, which tend to have similar, slightly tuneless.
So it's the person who wrote a lot of them. But you also wrote a lot of the music for the spiral dance.
I did. Some of the music I wrote for the spiral dance, if you actually take it apart, it's pretty simple musically. Other people who are more musical have taken it and arranged it and added to it and, again, brought it to another level. People come and build beautiful altars all around the space, and that kind of draws on the whole Latino Dia de los Muertos altar building tradition of this area that is a big influence on everything that we do as well. People dance invocations. We usually have aerialists who, I think we're probably one of the few traditions that has like aerial dance as part of our religious service. But and then the heart of the ritual is usually a trance where we take a journey to what we call the Isle of Apples. In pagan theology, when you die, you don't go to heaven and you don't go to hell. You go to the Isle of Apples where you walk with the goddess underneath the apple trees of immortality and grow young again and review your life until you grow young enough to be reborn. And that builds into a spiral that everyone dances together. So we'll have 1,500 people sometimes linked and dancing, and it's an amazing experience that raises a huge amount of energy that we direct into a vision of the world that we want to create. And the dance and the chanting and the song builds into this moment of harmony where everyone's voices are linked together that raises that energy, puts it out, and helps to move it out into the world and start moving those forces that can bring that vision to birth. And people can actually, you can actually go on YouTube and see a couple of, you know, clips from different rituals that I've put together. If you just Google Reclaiming Spiral Dance on YouTube.
Halloween is the time when we remember the dead and remind ourselves that death is a part of life, part of the cycles of birth, growth, death, and rebirth that we call goddess and god.
For you can see me in your eyes when they
there is no end.
And that was a little clip from the video that Starhawk was just talking about. This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley and online at kpfa.org. In a little while, we'll come back to Starhawk, and I'll be asking her about her involvement in the struggle for justice in Palestine and also about her work with the permaculture movement. This is Women's Magazine on listener-sponsored KPFA Radio and online at kpfa.org.
Reclaiming is an activist tradition.
I am the tide that's turning, your love and your rage.
We are
passion for justice burning.
For justice burning.
And when you take a stand, I'm the courage that guides you. I'm in the streets, I take your hand.
Let's return now to my conversation with Starhawk, author of The Spiral Dance, The Fifth Sacred Thing, and The Last Wild Witch.
One of the kind of surprising things about neo-paganism, mm-hmm. as a lot of us learned it from you, is how much of it is very rooted in traditions of Northern Europe, which I say is surprising because I know both of your parents were Russian Jews.
Well, I always say it's rooted in Northern Europe, but also in the Ukraine and in other parts of Europe. You know, people often think of craft as being Celtic, and there certainly is that strong influence in it. But if you go back into the history, go back to the Canaanites or go back to Sumer, go back to the goddess Inanna. For me, I think part of the gift of discovering these traditions, first of all, is learning that a really similar process went on just about everywhere in the world, that people who live close to nature understand that if we don't respect the elements of life, then we aren't going to live very well. If we go back far enough, all of us have that in our heritage somewhere. All of us have that in our roots.
So that sort of leads me into one of the things you're doing now, which is earth activist trainings. Mm-hmm. What are those and how did they get started?
The earth activist trainings are trainings that combine a permaculture design course with a grounding in spirit and a focus on organizing and activism. And for me, permaculture, which is a whole system and a global movement, it's a system of ecological design. It says, okay, let's look at the way nature works. And if we work in the same way nature works, we actually should be able to meet our human needs in ways that actually regenerate and heal the world around us instead of destroying it and exploiting it. And when I ran into that movement sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, and started to learn about it, to me, this is the practical application, of the idea that the earth is sacred. It also is a good balance for me from all the more sort of heady and, not just heady, but, esoteric aspects of ritual to the real hands-on practical,
Yeah, a lot of times when I call Starhawk, she's like, oh, hang on, I have to, wash the worms off of my hands.
Right. Yeah, you get out, you can call the elements in your living room, and meditate on them whenever, but you actually get out into them and put your hands in the earth, and it's a very different experience, and I love it. I love, gardening and pruning and caring for the earth. Permaculture isn't just about that, because the principles also apply in a lot of other ways, but that sure is a big part of it. So I had taken a permaculture design course with Penny Livingston Stark, who has an organization called the Regenerative Design Institute up in Marin County now, up in Bolinas. And then in 99, I went to Seattle to the WTO blockade. And after that, I got involved in going to a number of those different mobilizations, doing trainings, because I had learned to do nonviolence trainings back in the 80s when we were doing all the anti-nuclear work at Livermore and Vandenberg. I suddenly knew all these young activists, and I felt like they were on fire with this passion to change the world, but they didn't always know what they wanted to change it into. And at the same time, I knew all these people in the permaculture world and the natural building and the sustainability and the bioregional movement who had all of these solutions and all of these incredible techniques and skills and tools for changing and healing the earth, literally, but who sometimes didn't seem to have an awareness of the political forces that were at work or how to navigate around them. So Penny and I were talking about this, and we said, well, maybe we should do a training that brings together, you know, the permaculture with the political organizing. And, of course, we'll do that with the spiritual base because that's how we do everything. Earth Activist Training is also involved with a program in Bayview Hunters Point run by Hunters Point Family Organization that helps train youth in gardening skills, inner city and at-risk youth, to give them a different set of skills and to also provide food for the community and for farmers markets. Because one of the big social justice issues around food is that in many of the areas like the Bayview or like Oakland, it's really hard to even find fresh, good quality food or produce. You'll have a million liquor stores, but not even any supermarkets, let alone, you know, a Whole Foods or something like that, even if people could afford to buy it.
In one of your earliest books, I think it was in Dreaming the Dark, you described a public fight between you and a Palestinian woman at a feminist conference. And I remember being kind of embarrassed even reading it, although I also thought it was really brave of you to write about it like that. How did you get involved in Palestine solidarity work? How have your politics changed on that issue over the years?
That was in Truth or Dare, I think I wrote about that incident, yeah. You know, for me, like I think for a lot of people who are born and raised Jewish, and especially in the post-war era, you know, I grew up, you know, believing that Israel was the salvation of the Jews. You know, it was the thing that was sort of that we got in response to the horrors of the Holocaust. It was the place where you could be safe in the world as a Jew. I spent a summer in Israel when I was 15 with the Hebrew High School Ulpan on a youth village and being taken around touring the country. And when I think back on the stories and the way that I was taught to think about Israel and Palestine, you know, what really strikes me so much is how the Palestinians just weren't in the story at all. It's a very powerful narrative that says, hey, we were kicked around for 2,000 years. We were persecuted everywhere. We were nearly wiped out and exterminated. And now, at last, we have a land of our own again. And by God, nobody's going to take an inch of it away from us. That's a fine story. It just ignores the fact that there's another people there. And as I became aware of that fact, I became more and more uncomfortable about what Israel was doing.
And how did you become aware of that fact?
Somebody sent me an article about a woman named Netta Golan, who's an Israeli woman who had started living in Palestinian villages to be a witness and to sort of stand between the Palestinians and the Jewish settlers who would come into those villages and really attack them violently and attack especially the kids and the youth. And I read about that, and I found that really inspiring. And I wrote to Netta and just said, wow, I think you're doing really wonderful stuff, and it's really tremendously inspiring. And she wrote back and said, oh, Starhawk, I grew up on your books, because she was raised in Canada. And we started to email each other, and she was saying, why don't you come and do something here? And I was always, well, I'm already up to my ears in political work. Way too busy. Oh, I can't do it. And then I think it was in 2002 when the Israelis invaded Jenin in response to a bombing, a suicide bombing that had killed people at a hotel in Haifa, and just went nuts, like destroyed the entire refugee camp. This one bulldozer operator actually has an account of it that where he was drinking whiskey for 2 days and going crazy with the bulldozer and destroyed 400 homes. And a friend of mine, Robin Kossoff, was there doing solidarity work, went to Jenin, wrote a really heartrending account of what she saw. And at that point, something just clicked for me. And I said, I have to do something about this issue. I can't just be silent about it. And so I went that summer and volunteered with the International Solidarity Movement, met Netta, went into Palestine, was there in refugee camps when they were under siege, at checkpoints, seeing some of the real destruction that had gone on, being in Jenin that summer when the whole place was still a huge mountain of rubble. And it was a tremendous change for me. I mean, I feel like for me, that was in some ways the most profound spiritual experience of my life. I realized my fear was not really the tanks. It wasn't the soldiers. My real fear was the Palestinians, because everything in my life had led me to believe that they would hate me. And even my political shift that had brought me there didn't really give me any reason to think that they would like me, right? As a Jew and an American, as a representative of the people who were doing all this destruction. But to actually face that, walk there and say, okay, I'm going to stand in solidarity with these people anyway. And then to discover that, in fact, Palestinian people were really warm and welcoming.
Did you tell people that you were Jewish?
Yeah. And when I told people I was Jewish, people there had warned us not to for various reasons. But there were times, like I remember there was one family we stayed with, and I had my tarot cards with me. So I had been reading cards for people in their house, and these young women were like, oh, we know what that is. And then I had to read cards for everybody in the family. At one point, she looked at us and said, what religion are you? Are you Christian? And we looked at each other, because all three of us were Jews, And we didn't really know what to say, but we didn't want to lie. So we said, well, we're Jewish. And she just said, oh, beautiful. And I always think of Abu Ahmed, who I stayed at his house in Rafah. That was,
which is in Gaza.
In Gaza, that was on a later trip. But I went there in 2003. I went down to Gaza after Rachel Corey was killed to support the team that was with her. And one of the things we were doing was staying with houses that were on the border that were at risk of being bulldozed and attacked, because they were in the way of what the Israelis had decided was their security zone. So Abu Ahmed, he would look at us and he would sort of joke and say, oh, Star, she Jewish, she kill you and me. And then he'd laugh, right?
That is so Palestinian, I have to say.
And to also discover, that the Palestinian culture and the Jewish culture were much more similar than I think anyone wants to admit. I mean,
in what way?
Well, first of all, they'll both feed you until you're like past the bursting point. They value education in the same kind of way. The Palestinians have more PhDs per capita than any other people in the world. And that's partly a response to the horrors of the situation. People feel like education is one thing that they can't take away from you. The fundamentalists of both camps have a complete agreement about which parts of women should be covered.
Recently, you went on the Gaza Freedom March along with 1,300 or so other international activists. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you all were not allowed to cross from Egypt into Gaza. What was the purpose of that march? Why did you decide to go? And how do you feel about how it ended up?
Well, the purpose of the march really was twofold. One was to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza and to support the people in Gaza. And the second was to draw attention to the illegal siege conditions that the Israelis have imposed on Gaza and to put Gaza back in the news again. It's a year since the Israeli incursion into Gaza, and
that killed 1,400 Palestinians, I believe.
Killed 1,400 Palestinians and demolished something like 4,000 houses and 88 public buildings. You know, this was being organized by Code Pink and by a number of other organizations internationally. And when I heard about it, Jody Evans from Code Pink, you know, was writing to me about something and said, you know, can't you come on this? And I looked at it and went, well, I could come on that. And I had been wanting to go back to Gaza ever since I was there in 2003, but I haven't been able to go back. First, the border to Gaza was closed when I went back in 2004. And then since 2004, I haven't been allowed to go back into Israel, which also means the West Bank and the occupied territories at all, because they know that I was working with the International Solidarity Movement. And the Israelis really don't like people who have supported the nonviolent resistance, because I think they are very much afraid of the nonviolent resistance movement among the Palestinians. So
the Egyptian government didn't allow you all to cross through the Rafah border, which they control, to enter Gaza. Why not?
You know, what's going on there is that Israel controls the borders into Gaza. Israel controls all the borders except the Rafah, which is controlled by the Egyptians. But the Egyptians pretty much answer to Israel's tune, you know, as far as what they let in and out. And before the attacks, even since Hamas won the election in Gaza, Israel has basically shut the borders down and refused to allow commerce to go through, refused to allow a lot of really crucial supplies to go through into Gaza or out of Gaza. I think we were successful in at least, again, putting Gaza back on the media map and making it an issue again.
Yeah, I mean, actually, a congressman has just introduced something, a congressional resolution condemning the siege of Gaza, which if it managed to get through, to get passed in the U.S. Congress, which isn't very likely, would be the first time in many years that the U.S. Congress, you know, would take a position condemning any of Israel's war crimes. So, and I think that's probably directly attributable to the publicity around the Freedom March. So your latest book, The Last Wild Witch, has just come out from Mother Tongue, Inc. It's a children's book. Tell us about it.
So my latest book, The Last Wild Witch, is a picture book for children. It's a story about a perfect town in a perfect world where everyone always behaves perfectly, you know, right? And there's a rule for everything and a right way and a wrong way to do everything. And nobody ever breaks the rules except once in a while when the wind's from the west, and outside that perfect town is the last wild forest where the last wild witch brews up her magic brews. And so when the wind is in the right direction, some of that wildness gets inside the children and they don't behave so well. So the grown-ups decide they're going to cut down the forest and get rid of the wildness and get rid of the witch. And they go out and they first start to chop down the trees, but the trees scream. So they put plugs in their ears, and then they try to chop down the trees, but the trees drop branches and throw nuts at them. So they pad themselves up, and then they decide they're going to go burn down the forest. And meanwhile, the children keep running to the witch saying, you know, witch, they're going to kill you. What are you going to do? And the witch just says, have some soup. She's kind of a Jewish mother witch. Yeah, right. So finally, the children succeed in saving the forest and saving the witch. And I won't spoil it for you by telling you how. But it's a story I wrote many years ago, actually, when I was really, I was reading some, you know, a little story that had a negative image of a witch in it. And I got really sick of all the stereotypes about witches. And I thought there should be a good counter story to that. None of my major publishers wanted to touch it. I don't know why, you know. But the women who put out the Wee Moon calendar from Mother Tongue, Inc. Decided to do it. It's available. You can go to my website, which is starhawk.org, or to Mother Tongue Inc. And there's even a link, I think, from the Mother Tongue site. You can go to YouTube and hear me read it out loud. I like to think of it as a kind of subversive children's story.
Starhawk, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You're tuned to KPFA 94.1 FM. I'm Kate Raphael on Women's Magazine.